Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 99 for Thursday, April 21st, 2011. Barbs in Ford Land. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, here we are, folks, after a one-week hiatus. Peter and I were both gone last week, but we're both here this week. And so, hello, sir.
Hello, Gianni.
It's good to be here again with you.
Yeah, how so?
Yeah.
Tell me all about Taiwan.
Oh, I'll tell you about Taiwan, but we should tell our viewers, too, that joining us later in the show, we're going to have Barb Smarditch, who's in charge of all global programs at Ford. And so get your questions in for that, because it ought to be a pretty good talk. But Taiwan was amazing. I'd never been there before. I've been to Asia a lot, Japan, China, South Korea, and the like, but Taiwan's different. I saw a new car company that started up there called LuxGen, which is a combination of luxury and genius. And it's kind of I don't think the name is really going to do the company much justice, but I was knocked out by their product line.
Really?
They've got an SUV and a minivan, which they call an MPV, you know, multi-purpose vehicle, but it's a minivan, that they're already selling in Taiwan. They got a sedan coming next year, and then they got a compact hatchback coming after that. But what blew me away was how well turned out these cars were. Mm-hmm. They're part of a company that's got a joint venture with Nissan to build cars in Taiwan. But Nissan wouldn't let them touch any other platform, any other technology, or anything like that. And these guys were itching to do their own car, so they went out and did it. And they've got this platform that, from the get-go, is designed to take an internal combustion engine or do it as a plug-in hybrid or do it as a battery electric. So they've got four vehicles coming off. I think it's essentially one platform. And Taiwan, as you probably know, is the contract manufacturing center for consumer electronic stuff in the world.
Right.
All the Apple iPods, iPads, all that stuff is actually made by a Taiwanese company. A lot of their assembly is done in China right now because even Taiwan's too high cost. But they make all the components. They do a lot of the engineering work and whatnot. So not only have they taken this very clever approach of having a platform to spin off multiple models and do plug-in battery electric or ICE, it's chock full of Taiwanese electronic stuff that's really impressive.
So where will we see these?
They exhibited at the Shanghai Auto Show this week. And as they told me, their goal is to get to China, but their dream is to come to the United States. They just think, oh, yeah, anybody can sell cars in China, but if you can sell them in America, wow, that means you're really something. So they would love to come here. But what was kind of funny in talking with these guys is technically they're superb. You want to go anywhere technologically, they're already five steps ahead of you. They know nothing about wholesale, retail, sales, marketing, advertising. I mean, they're not that. They're all a bunch of tech guys that have come out with these pretty good-looking cars. And one of the reasons they look good is they hired away one of GM's top designers. Very interesting guy. He and I hit it off immediately. He's born in Japan, went to Art Center in Pasadena. I don't know if he was running GM's studio in China or if he was one of the high muckety-muck guys. Mm-hmm. Anyway, LuxGen hired him away. And so the cars look pretty good. The build quality is as good as anything that's out there. And some of their technology is literally bleeding edge. Like, you know, their nav screen is 10.2 inches. It's gigantic. I mean, you look at in the car, and it's just massive. And I saw a lot of other cool technology while I was in Taiwan, like these flexible speakers. They're literally paper thin, like thin cardboard. But you can twist them and roll them. You can even take scissors and cut them into any shape you want to fit them anywhere you want, including in a car. And so I was pretty impressed by a lot of the stuff that I saw there.
That's good.
And you weren't here last week because you were at Long Beach.
Long Beach.
So tell me about that.
The Long Beach Grand Prix, the traditional weekend in Southern California that's completely underwritten by Toyota. They have their pro celebrity race, which is getting more tedious by the year. They're going to have to rethink that.
Why? It's just boring.
Yeah, it's just boring. And
do they have big names? Way in the beginning, they had big celebrity names. Maybe they're not so big anymore.
Not so much anymore. And, you know, it was a dual weekend, which I think is the future of American road racing. ALMS on one day, IndyCar on the next. And I had a very interesting meeting with Randy Bernard, the head of IndyCar.
The new guy who's been brought in to shake it up.
I have never seen anyone come into a racing series and gain more acceptability and you know, everyone thinks the world of this guy.
Well, he ran professional rodeos,
Well, professional bull riding.
Bull riding, excuse
TBR.
Me.
He turned that from nothing into something. And the guy's got great instincts. You know, he doesn't know everything there is to know about racing, but that's okay. He has great instincts, and he's got really, really good marketing savvy going on. And he listens. I'm kind of in his kitchen cabinet about IndyCar. Me and Robin Miller and I think Gordon Kirby. But he listens, and, you know, the buzz in the paddock at IndyCar at that weekend was the upper trajectory was IndyCar. Not so much ALMS, because here they were coming off of Sebring. They had two top-class prototypes. They had a bunch of the smaller prototypes, and then they had the GTs. And after Long Beach, there's a seven-week break. I mean, they don't come back.
That kills the momentum.
Yeah, they don't come back.
You can't go away for 7 weeks.
No, they don't come back to July 9th or something.
Wow.
And I just think it's time. And, you know, they're connected to the 24-hour Le Mans, which is their reason for being. I mean, that connection is key. I mean, because that is the biggest road racing event of the summer, an endurance event in the world.
Well, really of the year.
Yeah, of the year. The problem is ALMS is so tied to them that the rest of the season just goes away here. And Scott Atherton is going to have to get with Don Panos, and they're going to have to say, look, you know, we will fulfill our obligations to the French to keep going to the race. We'll have them come over for the Petit Le Mans Sebring, but they have to go their own way. They really have to work on their fan base. But what I would like to see in American road racing right now, because I'm confident Randy Bernard is going to take IndyCar up. About 2013, IndyCar is going to be...
Why? How do you think he's going to be able to do it?
Well, we're getting three manufacturers by 2012. We're getting a new chassis. The aero body kits that the manufacturers are free to do on their own, you're going to see even Formula One teams doing body kits, you know, for these cars. So I think, and he's going to bring more technology in. And I think the combination of that, and I wouldn't be surprised if he takes a flyer on the Delta Wing.
The Delta Wing car.
Yeah.
You and I love the look.
Yeah, lets it run. I think he should let it run, so I really am confident by about 2013, IndyCar is really going to be back to even bigger than it ever was, a premier series again. American road racing, sports car racing, something's got to give. I mean, this Grand Am, ALMS, you got World Challenge.
It's too much.
It's too much.
Nobody can keep track.
Somebody's got to step up and say, time out. we're going to do one great road racing series. And, of course, we won't see that in our lifetime because as long as, you know, ALMS with Don Panos and then Jim Prance on the other side with Grand Am, I know they've talked, but I don't see them getting together. If they could get over themselves and get together and really work on one great series, we'd all be better off for it. But as it was, the GT racing is the best road racing I've seen since the 70 Trans Am series. I mean, it is absolutely a magnificent racing. And I would like to see it showcased. I mean, just, yeah, I can imagine a field of 22 or 4 top GT cars from a bunch of manufacturers squaring off. I think it'd be huge.
It'd be awesome. You know, speaking of where IndyCar could go, I love this movable wing that they've introduced in Formula One.
Yeah.
I think the way that they apply it, only after a few laps and you have to be, you know, within X meters and it can only be, that's totally stupid. But I've always been a big proponent of active aerodynamic stuff. And
it was pioneered here in the U.S.
Sure it was. Well, actually, I would give more credit to, and somebody else will find something earlier, but, you know, Mercedes-Benz.
And they had the air brake in the 50s.
Right. But if you look at Jim Hall.
But Jim Hall and Chevrolet Engineering, they
took it to a fine art. And today, with electronics and much better materials than they had in the 60s, you could do some wicked good stuff with active aero. And, you know, I'd love to see Indy pioneer that kind of stuff because it doesn't have to be real expensive.
Yeah.
You're talking about very simple actuators and, you know, it's not like megabucks that you got to throw into a car.
Well, once again, Indy will always run up against that. How fast are they going to let the cars go at the speedway? At the peak with Ari Leyendijk when he sat on the pole and was almost 240. 238. I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't know what that means.
Well, but I still remember when Parnelli Jones did laps of 150 and people said, that's it. You can never go faster than that. And they were right for that technology.
They can go faster. I think they would have to re-engineer the catch fencing, and they would have to. It would be a totally different looking.
Well, one of the the easiest way to cut down speeds is just cut down the tire size.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, if you're going to embrace technology in IndyCar, then why are they still running 15-inch diameter, wheels and tires on the things? I mean, really? Come on, you know, run 13s in the front or do something. Let the manufacturers have their way a little bit. Mm-hmm. Then I think we'll see multiple tire makers again. Because
mm-hmm.
Michelin, for instance, I think Michelin needs to be at the Speedway. I mean, they are a huge global name. They're a huge name in the U.S. market. I think they need to be at Indy. But they want to see, you know, they'd like to see other than 15-inch wheels and tires on the cars. It's like, where's the challenge, you know? Let us, you know. That's why the Delta Wing was, that's why you and I love the Delta Wing.
Right. Well, it looks so radically different. It appears to have a huge aerodynamic advantage. And
Let it run against the V6 twin turbos. Let it, you know, maybe it won't run very well, but let it run.
Right.
Let people see it. It'll just draw more interest. And, you know, Randy Bernard's smart enough. He knows, you know, we need, you know, more sponsors, more manufacturers. That brings more fan interest, more attendance in person, bigger TV numbers, on and on and on. But I do feel an upward trajectory in IndyCar, definitely. But the highlight was the dinner Thursday night by the Road Racing Drivers Club, which is a fundraiser for their young driver support, and it honored Roger Penske. And it was just a fabulous event. I mean, anyone in racing was there, and you rarely see Roger take a break, you know, and it was nice to see. And the coolest thing, they had these huge blow-up pictures of famous cars that Roger either was driving or owned. There was
because a lot of people don't know that. He was a pretty good driver.
He was a great driver. He drove for Jim Hall. He was the lead driver for Chaparral. And they had one picture was him in the Chaparral in Nassau. And I bid on, of course, you know, somebody else tripled it or something, but it was very good. It was a really nice event, and I think they've only honored three people. Roger was a third, and I think they've honored Dan Gurney and I think Parnelli Jones. Oh. So who knows who's going to be next year. I would assume Mario would be high on the list.
Too, right.
But that was a special evening. There are 400 people there.
Wow.
It's a big deal.
Hey, this week we had a lot of news coming out of New York and Shanghai.
Yeah.
And anything catch your eye coming out of either one of those shows?
Well, I have to say I was pretty impressed with the Scion. They decided to call it a Scion instead of Toyota, which is the joint project with Subaru with the Boxer motor, and which is direct and port injected. But I just like the idea that it's a rear-wheel drive sports coupe.
Mm-hmm.
Designed from the get-go as a rear-wheel drive. You don't see that very much anymore.
No, you don't.
And I think they did a nice job with it. New Malibu's, yeah, it's nice. The freshened Taurus, I think, is really nice, except I wish they wouldn't have shown it in New York since it won't be out for a year.
Oh, yeah. Geez, I didn't realize it was going to take that long.
Yeah, it'll be out as of 2013 next year from now.
It gives the car a cleaner, lighter look is the way that I described it.
Yeah, yeah. And the SHL looks even more aggressive. And they tweaked it, did a nice job on it. What did you like from New York?
Well, certain things that I found interesting was that Lexus, I think it's the LH, that is the new look of Lexus, the nose on that. We had a piece of Mark Templin in today's show talking about that's how Lexus is going to look. You're going to see that front end roll out across their line.
Well, we've seen this in other manufacturers. You know, Cadillac, you know, they reinvented themselves, and part of that is establishing a face out on the road. That Lexus face is going to take some time to get used to.
It is, but man, it's dramatic.
Yeah, it is.
It really is dramatic, and it's
the rest of their cars don't go with it, though.
No, they don't. No, that's a good point. They really don't.
They showed that, and it's like, and I think I put on the site, well, that's nice, but when are you going to put a rest of the car with it? If you hang that front end on their current cars, it's
really gonna work.
No, it's bad.
I like the Mercedes A-Class, too. I thought that was a super stylish car for an A-Class
car. If they don't dumb it down for production.
Well, they will. I mean, that was a concept.
And I thought the Audi Q3 was really nice in Shanghai.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to remember who had what else there. But those were probably the highlights.
Well, you know, what Chrysler showed some, the new SRT8 300, and Jeep. They also showed us yet another Wrangler special edition, and the Fiat 500 with the Cabriolet.
Yeah, Cabriolet. But you know, those are all modifications of existing designs.
Yeah, so. I mean, we saw that in Paris two years ago.
Well, look, why don't we take a quick break here for one of our sponsor messages and bring Barb Smarditch on.
Sounds good.
Barb, why don't you come up here? But I'm going to tell our audience that we've got Hyundai back as a sponsor. Want to talk about the new Sonata. Come and have a seat here, and you got to clip on your own microphone. The Sonata's on its sixth-generation design, very fluidic design. I'm sure most of you have seen it. Gives it a very sporty look and feel. And, of course, it kind of looks like a coupe, even though it's a four-door sedan. It's got very stylish and modern styling both inside and out. They like to point out that it's got eco-friendly soy-based seats. So very...
Which I believe Ford pioneered.
Yeah.
Didn't you pioneer those?
Yeah. I think so.
And one last thing that I want to point out about the Sonata is... They like to point out it has a large car interior, at least as measured by the EPA, so roomy inside, even though it's not gigantic on the outside. But anyway, Barb, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
So I'm sure everybody trips over your last name. Am I saying it right, Smarditch?
Close enough. Yeah. I tell people, ignore the D, because there's a D and a Z together, so Samarzich.
Samarzich. Okay.
But it's fine.
It sounds like the... football star from Notre Dame who played, Jeff Samardzic, who went on to play baseball. Some very similar name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not uncommon, Yugoslavian. Mm-hmm. This is my husband's. My maiden name was Tuttle. Never mispronounced, yeah. Never misspelled. I'll just point that out.
So you're running all the programs at Ford right now.
Yes, I am.
And you'd been doing powertrain before that?
Yeah, I've many years in powertrain. I've been with Ford a total of about 20 years, and I'd say 12 of them at least have been in the powertrain arena in different functions. And prior to this job, I was the vice president of powertrain.
So
for 5 years.
You can take a lot of the credit for EcoBoost then.
Well, that's definitely a team sport. My powertrain team can take a lot of credit for EcoBoost.
And I see that it's going in the Taurus, too. The 2-liter mm-hmm. EcoBoost yes. is going in the Taurus.
That's yes. the big news of the new car.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. So we'll see that 2-liter first in the Explorer and in the Edge. We'll see that a little later this year. And then we'll roll it out into the Taurus. So very excited about that. Time, you know, we knew when we came up with the EcoBoost strategy that fuel prices would go up. Couldn't tell you exactly when. Right now, they're actually going up faster than I think we anticipated. As you know, you see it hitting about $4 a gallon. So rolling out that EcoBoost engine and giving folks a real fuel economy alternative, I think we timed this pretty well.
And, Jen, you've driven it in the Edge.
I drove it in the Edge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hate to sound like such a suck-up with Barb sitting here, but I was blown away at how good a 2-liter engine could perform in something like the Edge. Really impressed.
The team has done a fantastic job. I took an Explorer home because I said, you know, I haven't driven one of these in a while. I'm going to take one home and really experience it. And I was the same way. I thought a performance feel is just a knockout.
Yeah, because a lot of turbocharged engines up to now, four-cylinder especially, you know, they feel like they're straining. I mean, and they typically would come on like a sledgehammer, you know, rev way up. But it didn't feel like it had any torque to it. Mm-hmm. That's not the case with the EcoBoost 2-liter that you've got. It feels torquey.
Yeah. I think we have a very good powertrain match. So we've got the right transmission, got the shift points set correctly. And just through the whole powertrain matching program, I think we learned an awful lot through this. I will say it was not easy because we're probably now at about the boundaries of how small a displacement engine you could go in a vehicle, say the size of an Explorer or as we put into some of the other vehicles. And that learning on how to execute it, and you always want to push the teams to the limit, right? Otherwise, we're not really doing our jobs. But make sure that we deliver the attributes perfectly for the customer. This was we definitely learned a lot through this one, but we got there. I'll be really excited to roll that out.
So what's the secret then? The software control? I mean, turbocharged, four-cylinder, direct injection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
even DCT transmissions have been around. So I got to believe the secret sauce is the controls.
Well, the hardware is definitely part of the enabler. So the control we can have now with direct injection, the control we can have on turbos, the ability to keep the turbos cool. So one of the things you'll see when we roll this engine out is that we've kind of integrated the exhaust manifold into the cylinder head so we can water cool it. Because temperature is one of the things you'll fight in a turbocharged engine. So the more you can keep everything cool and keep the exhaust cool, as it feeds back in, the better your opportunity to have a good performance feel.
Let me just stop you right there. Mm-hmm. Explain a little bit. How have you integrated the exhaust system into the head?
Literally by designing some of the channels for the exhaust as it's coming out to go through into the head as it's heading back into the turbocharger to be able to integrate it in the head so that we can have the cooling channels and the water that flows through the cylinder head cool that exhaust flow. So when it heads back into the turbocharger, it's at a lower temperature than if you normally have it just external to the head, which is the way a lot of engines have been set up. Hmm. So, but how they did it, they just really creative team. We've got, you know, it's just designed in there. I guess it's the only way I could describe it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to see this to fully understand
it.
But then it was the controls that...
But then the controls are really a huge enabler in, you know, not just in the ability to get the maximum performance feel for customers out of a smaller engine and a larger vehicle, but almost all the work we do these days, the emission requirements, those types of things, the control strategies is really the enabler. It's just amazing what, the electronics capability the teams have now.
You also have a 1.6 liter coming, too, I think, in... Mm-hmm. In the passenger cars, how low can you go in displacement? Yeah. Fiat's got, for example, a 2-cylinder engine out right now in Europe. for the Fiat 500. You must be looking at something like that, too.
You know, we've done a lot of studies and done a lot of work in our research group to answer that question, how low can you go? Because there is a limit. And what you see is that as you start to continue to go down in displacement and putting in so the vehicle weight is going up for that particular displacement, you will hit a point where the engine has to operate at such a higher RPM to be able to give the performance feel or to be able to have the drivability that a customer would expect, to have the torque demand, that you negate the benefit of the reduced displacement. So the whole reason for an EcoBoost and for downsizing is to get the benefit of that smaller displacement, which is the biggest lever you can pull for improving fuel economy. But if you actually take it too far, you will negate it. And it's, you know, think of it as kind of a curve. I'm getting better fuel. Everything's great. Then I hit this is the optimum point. And now if I continue to go downsizing or you continue to increase the weight of the vehicle, you put that engine in, you start to go back up a curve and it doesn't become as efficient in the fully loaded conditions. So when you're really pushing it hard, that's where you want to make sure you haven't, that's where you make sure you're paying attention to those limits that you want to set.
What can you tell us about, which is out, I guess, June of 12, of the ST, the engine that's going to go in the Focus ST, isn't that? Can you say anything about that?
I don't think we've given any specifics on it at all yet, but it'll be one of our EcoBoost family. So it'll have all the performance feel anyone would expect from a Focus ST.
Around 250 horsepower, rumored to be.
I can't say any of those.
Hey, Peter and I were talking about this earlier in the show, or before the show. Hyundai Sonata, no V6. Now Chevrolet has said the same thing with mm-hmm. the Malibu. I got to believe that you guys are looking at the same kind of strategy with cars like the Fusion.
Yeah, clearly as we go forward and we start launching our new products, getting customers more and more comfortable with that downsizing, that EcoBoost strategy, which has proven really well, is clearly where we're heading also.
Because you can change, you can design with a reduced mass, you can make all kinds of advantageous decisions in building the vehicle. So
well,
if you don't have to accommodate a V6, then you can redo the whole platform, right?
You have that opportunity, but the biggest opportunity for the customer is they get the fuel economy of that four-cylinder engine and without having the big V6 in there. So they're getting all the fuel economy of a four-cylinder. They're getting the V6 performance feel, the V6 torque and horsepower, and they're, you know, it's just a tremendous advantage for the customer. But the place we've done it, the number one place we've done it, which will be, for me, is the real test of how well Americans are going to adopt a downsizing strategy is our F-Series. So just this, you know, within the last 2 months, we launched our 3.5-liter EcoBoost engine in the F-Series as an alternative to a V8. And right now,
you charge more for it, too, right?
Well, I got to leave the pricing to the pricing experts. Well, think about it. You know, it's 400-foot-pound engine, so it's got the same torque, which is what truck customers really care about, as a big V8 that they'd be used to, you know, 400 foot-pounds. And you got the full towing capability, 10,000 pounds, that you'd have with a big V8, but you're getting fuel economy that's way better. So there is value to that. A customer can quickly do the calculations. And as we've kept, as we've looked at pricing on EcoBoost, one of the things that we have paid very much attention to is how fast does this pay back? You don't have value for a customer if it's going to take them 6 years to pay it back. But if they pay this back in, you know, a year and a half, and it's probably even less now, the payback time, because fuel has gone up from when we, you know, first started doing some of those calculations, then it's got a lot of value for the customer. So it's a win-win for both of us.
So how's it doing? Is it too early to tell? Or?
It's excellent. Right now, all I know is Jim Farley is telling us they need more, you know, and Ken Zube, who heads our sales in North America, that, you know, they can't keep them in the dealer's lot. So it's really timed well, and it's an outstanding product.
I was at a Ford dealer about a month ago, and I know a guy who works at one and was asking him about it, and he says they can't get enough, and it's bringing in all kinds of customers. Mm-hmm. You just want to at least check it out, see what it's all about.
So I think that for that customer to feel very comfortable with the turbocharged engine, a downsized engine, says, you know, in a car, it's an absolute natural in the car products.
So as you're planning Ford's global programs here, where do you see some real opportunities?
Well, I think the biggest opportunity is to really continue to leverage what we're doing globally. So right now we've really got to the point where we've started to launch in every region these global products. We got a global Fiesta out, a global Fusion out. I'm sorry, a global Focus out, and we're just keep working our way through them all. And the real opportunity, at least in my current job, is to leverage the benefits of that for us and for our customers, the economies of scale that brings, the economies in the engineering work, because we're engineering it once and being able to utilize it across the globe, having common bill of process in our plants so that our manufacturing plants can leverage that economies of scale, whether it's in Chongqing in China or whether it's in Pacheco down in South America or here in the U.S. So it's really... the biggest opportunity is to harvest all of that for our customers, and then we pass that. You know, you pass that on.
So the real benefits of this really haven't fully hit, is what I think I'm hearing you say.
I feel that way because, this has been a journey, a long journey that we've been on about the last 5 or 6 years.
One Ford.
Yeah, it's been a journey, and we're just realizing the fruits of it. There are clearly some learnings along the way, some things that we didn't realize initially that we now know we can go back and get. And then we have to finish that whole journey, you know, with our Transit product, with our Fusion products, with all the other products that we have lined up to go to take them on a global basis.
What's Ford doing in terms of going upscale? And the reason I ask it is this. Ford was very profitable last year. I think the second most profitable car company in the world, which is astonishing compared to where it was just a few years earlier. Number one profit maker in the world was Volkswagen, which has brands like Audi and Lamborghini and Bugatti and so on and so forth. And I just see Volkswagen being able to pull farther and farther ahead of Ford because of that. How do you respond from a product standpoint to get something more upscale that can make more money for the company?
Well, two things. One is I think we made a very good decision, and, you know, Alan Mulally had a very good focal point around one Ford. So we had a lot of upscale brands, but our ability to really focus on the Ford brand is what ultimately led us to be able to have such a great year last year in that profitability. But the second thing is a clear recognition that we do need a luxury brand. And we've been very clear that Lincoln is where we want to invest our time, energy, and develop a real luxury premium product. So right now, you know, we've got a whole group of people that are focused on what does luxury really mean, and then integrating that into our Lincoln brand. And, you know, no one's saying that's going to be easy. We've got a marketplace to deal with. We've got perceptions that are out there already that we're going to have to change. But I know we've got the ability to do it. I know we can put the product on the road that'll satisfy the customer. And then it's that question of time and consistent delivery until they start recognizing it. But we, you know, made a very clear statement that Lincoln is going to be where we invest in terms of having a luxury brand.
What's your thought then? Does a luxury car or a luxury brand at least have to have one or two vehicles that are rear drive?
You know, that's always a good debate at Ford, that's for sure, because we do have a rear-wheel drive platform. We have the Mustang, and right now it's actually not a global platform. It's regional, and, you know, it's going to be with us a very long time. So having opportunity to leverage a platform for a Lincoln brand is something we're always looking at. But as you look, as you fast forward, all-wheel drive capability and the technologies like disconnect when you want to disconnect your all-wheel drive, those types of technologies I think are going to enable luxury brand to be seen more for the attributes it delivers rather than whether it's a rear-wheel drive or, you know, whether it's a front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive. And there's a real definitive set of performance feel, drivability, you know, and technologies like torque vectoring that really will enable front-wheel drive and all-wheel drive platforms to deliver the benefits that they deliver, because there's a lot of customers that just feel more comfortable with driving an all-wheel drive or a front-wheel drive in a place like, you know, Detroit, where you got a lot of snow in the winter, you got a lot of ice, and you may not have a choice for a second car that you're going to drive if the weather's bad, but at the same time provide some of the driving dynamics that rear-wheel drives are known for.
And
so leveraging those technologies on our Lincoln brand is really what is really the key for us.
Will Lincoln get its own platform or platforms?
You know, I'm not going to speculate on where we're going to go on that, so.
She'll have to take the Sergeant Schultz.
I'll have to take the fifth to take here when you don't want to answer any of those.
That's right.
You know, you just say, I got to take the Sergeant Schultz on that one.
Yeah, and then, and I got to believe another big discussion has been, do you take the Lincoln brand global?
Yeah, that's another one that I wouldn't give specifics on, but I believe as we develop it into the luxury brand that it can be, it certainly would have a home in some other markets outside the United States.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that's a long view. You got to go end up in China with it. So,
China and a number of other places. I've said all along, you know, if you really want to take on Mercedes, BMW, Audi, you got to go global. And, you know, an advantage of them being global is they can come out with these what look to us like very low volume products. But again, they're building them all around the world or selling them all around the world, I should say. And so they can exploit these little niches in the American luxury segment that heretofore Cadillac and Lincoln have never been able to respond to, again, because they're a global car companies that sell all over the world. So what may seem like very low volume to us here is probably decent enough volume to justify doing those vehicles.
Yeah.
So let's take another break here. And I'm sorry, it's got to be for one of your competitors here, Barb.
Okay. But I'll try to be quiet.
Okay. I want to take a moment to talk about Chevrolet Cruze, which you can check out at chevrolet.com/cruze, and of course that's C-R-U-Z-E. You can get the all-new Cruze Standard with either a 6-speed manual or 6-speed automatic, premium Pioneer 9-speaker sound system. It's got all kinds of other things that you ought to check out, including some pretty good fuel economy here.
They showed that Eco.
Well, they showed the Malibu Eco
at
the New York show.
That was like 38 on the highway.
Was it that? Okay. And, of course, the Cruze Eco is 41 highway.
Right.
And you can check that all out at chevrolet.com/cruze. And, of course, that's C-R-U-Z-E. And so where else? What else you want to talk about here, Barb?
Oh, my. Let's see.
What do you like to do on your free time that
free
you
time.
Don't have?
Free time?
What is that?
Actually, the team, we were talking today, and we said, we get a three-day weekend. Maybe we'll get 2 days off.
Right.
So, what I've been spending time on now, my son is a senior in high school. So, you know, he got all the college stuff back, and now it's went around and visited several of the colleges for him to make a decision on where he wants to go.
Ooh.
So.
Big decision
That's big decision time. That is big decision time.
In all the global platforms, then you play with everything, truck, commercial, pass car, Australia, Europe, everything.
Yeah, again, operating as one global product development organization, then we're looking at the developing all the products across this one group. So, you know, we're a global organization, and we cover all the products, whether it's, you know, the sub Bs or all the way up to the, you know, the full size Super Duties and even the cargos. You know, we have responsibility, and my team has responsibility for the cargos that we do in Turkey as well as down in South America. So it's been an interesting 3.5 months that I've been in the job.
We have more than a few fans in Australia, and they're always peppering us with questions about what's going to happen with the Falcon there. What's going to happen with the Falcon there?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, I can't talk about any future product plans. But as we look through all the different regions and the still regional products we have, one of the things that, you know, is very important from our planning perspective is how do we leverage some of the common platforms that we can have now to make sure we provide the product that meets those needs in each one of the regions.
Mm-hmm.
That's a critical function.
I guess we can talk about colleges you visited.
That gets you a new product. You know, way in the future type stuff.
But the Falcon's rear...
We can talk hypothetically.
The Falcon's rear drive, isn't it?
The Falcon, yes.
Yeah.
The Falcon is a rear-wheel drive platform.
So you have two rear drive platforms.
Yeah, that's
pass
true.
Car.
That's true. We do have two rear-wheel drive platforms.
At least for not right now.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
I mean, you can envision if the next generation Mustang will also have to... There might be a Lincoln based off that platform, too.
One would think.
Yeah.
That's right. Barb seems
our
to be
planners
hinting
are
at
always, our planners are always looking at how do we optimize what assets we have and how do we, you know, maximize the great product we can bring out to our customers. So we're always trying to do that, for sure.
Cool. You know, we're about ready for rapid fire here, but we should take one more commercial break because I'd like to do that before interrupting rapid fire, because once we get rolling on that, we get rolling. So I want to take another moment here to thank Bridgestone Tire, and specifically Bridgestone America's tire operation. Bridgestone, of course, is the world's largest tire company. They have a full line of premium products, whether it's their run flat tire, their winter tires, their performance or touring tires. They would like me to say it's Bridgestone or nothing. And you can check that all out at BridgestoneTire.com. And they really do have some good stuff there. So let's, Ben, let's get to rapid fire. Our first question is from Sandy Barua, who actually runs the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. And he says, like many, I'm really rooting for Lincoln's renaissance. What can you say? This is to you, Barb. Mm-hmm. What can you say about Lincoln regarding hybrid drive with all-wheel drive, diesels, and a return to a rear-wheel drive flagship?
Okay, we already been through rear-wheel drive, but in terms of hybrid, we have a Lincoln hybrid out there right now, our MKZ. So that's available.
Oh, that's a great question. Now you have the option of going just hybrid or no hybrid,
same
right?
MSRP. You can go hybrid or non-hybrid.
What's the take rate on the hybrid?
Oh, I don't know it off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Last time I checked, it was doing very well.
It's doing very well, but I don't have the percentage off the top of my head how many go with them.
I've been meaning to look that up.
I should get that number.
I want to get that number. Because if it's not 100%, I'm going to say, what's wrong with hybrids? I mean, because as you know, they're still less than 3% of the market.
It is a fantastic powertrain, fantastic propulsion system.
I just had one.
Absolutely fantastic.
Great.
But I still say, you know, total hybrid sales are still less than 3% of the U.S. market, and 75% of that less than 3% are all Toyotas. So, that's why I remain a hybrid skeptic.
Well, as you look at hybrid sales, they are very dependent also on what's going on with fuel prices. So as fuel prices go up, hybrid sales will
go up.
And we've seen
maybe
that
get to 3%.
Yeah. And diesel, I'll answer this more generically, but it'll absolutely apply to Lincoln also. Diesels in the United States in passenger cars is just economics for me and for the customers too. So a diesel engine in the U.S. To emissionize it costs even more than it does to emissionize it in Europe. And just to give an example, the NOx limits in the United States now with our current emission levels are more stringent than the NOx levels for Euro Stage 6, which hasn't come into play yet. So we have a very, very stringent emission levels for diesels, requires a lot of aftertreatment to put on it. So it becomes a proposition that you have to, you know, pay a premium at the dealership, at least some level of premium. Typically, right now, if you go to buy a passenger car diesel, maybe a $2,000, premium would seem like a reasonable one. And then if you look at the price of diesel versus petrol in the gas stations, I think now it's probably about 30 cents at least, if not more. I've seen it even recently as much as 40.
30 cents is what I saw today.
30 cents is about the delta between regular petrol and a diesel, or petrol and a diesel. Diesel fuel. And if you just do the math, even though the diesel's getting you more miles on that every gallon you put in, but every time you're at the pump, you're paying more for each gallon. It goes back to that payback discussion we talked about on EcoBoost. You know, if customers make very rational decisions. So if it pays me back, you know, in a year and a half, that's a good payback. I'm, you know, going to keep my car 4 years. I'll more than earn that back. But if it takes me 7 years to pay it back, it's going to be a little bit of a harder decision.
That's a real failure of our EPA.
So that to me is the bottom line why diesels, you know, much as I know Volkswagen tries, and some Mercedes and BMW certainly have, you know, performance higher-end diesels. But overall, it's not something that customers are really demanding in the United States because it's very hard to make the business case for them, for the customer to make.
I'm told for a V6 or a V8, you're looking at about $4,000 in emissions equipment.
That's probably not—that's probably a little high, but it's, I mean, it's thousands.
But to me, that points to the failure of an EPA and the way they go about it, because if they just backed off a little
bit. Just a little bit. Right. Especially on NOx, like you're mentioning.
It would save the consumers money, it would save the manufacturers money, and we'd see more affordable diesels, and it would make sense if they just backed up. But there's no vision.
Well, it has to be also with the working in conjunction with the oil companies, because in Europe there was a conscious decision by the governments to have a CO2 solution that included diesel. So they taxed petrol, so it was always above diesel, and that really drove people to they do the math real quick,
right.
And they say this is great. I don't ever hardly have to go fill it up.
But you're saying. The next round of emission standards in Europe still will not catch up to where we are today.
I believe
So that's why I agree with Peter. Just back off a little bit, and man, we could see some real fuel economy improvements.
Yeah,
and it's not like we're going to be killing people from dirtier air.
Yeah.
No, that's such a misconception on diesels that I still think is in the United States a little bit too. That noisy diesel, mm-hmm. which that's not it at all anymore.
Okay, we've got another question here that goes to you, Barb. This guy says, who is this? This goes on a little while, but okay, it's from C. Newstrand from Birmingham, Alabama. He says, I think Ford's shooting themselves in the foot by not updating the Ford Ranger in the U.S. market. We get a lot of mail on this. And he's owned a Ranger for 17 years. He needs to replace it. He doesn't like the Nissan Frontier, the mm-hmm. Toyota Tacoma. He says the F-150 is a nice truck, but it's too big for me. Why not the Ford Ranger here?
Yeah, as you look at where Ranger and its competitors have gone in this marketplace, excuse me, over the past several years, the physical size of those vehicles is getting bigger. So if you look at the Tacoma, if you look at anybody who's put one out, they're getting physically bigger, and they start to encroach on F-150. At the same time, as we're working on our next generation F-150, one of the key attributes there is taking out substantial weight to get a fuel economy a fuel economy delivery that really, again, starts to come down and impinge on where a Ranger would be. So we just did a new global Ranger, and we've got it, we just rolled it out at several auto shows, about to launch it very soon. That vehicle does kind of get close to the size of an F-150, so it creates a situation where if you really need a pickup truck, we've got the perfect pickup truck, it's an F-150. And then as we continue to take weight out, take the fuel economy down, it meets what those customers that currently buy Rangers really are looking for is good fuel economy. That's what they really are driving for. And we've got the technologies that we've been adding to and continue to add to an F-150 to deliver that.
But one Ford, right? I mean, do you see a mm-hmm. point down the road where it converges?
Well, that's a good question, because we're, a bit of a unique marketplace with F-Series types of trucks.
We have so much volume in the F-Series in North America. Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's only in this market.
Oh, yeah. F-Series has so much volume that it is almost, it's like a global product. But it's interesting, this is the only market that has that type of trucks. Everywhere else, they use Ranger. And don't get any bigger than Ranger with a pickup truck like an F-Series. And then they move into the transit-style trucks,
mm-hmm.
That very cab-forward transit-style trucks. And it's interesting. That's the way it is pretty much everywhere.
Right. But here, the Ranger, the new Ranger, is coming awfully close to the F-150
yeah.
in total capability. And so that's why I wonder, could it converge, at least the platform converge mm-hmm. at some point?
Yeah, and that's something we always look at, too, as we do our product planning, where we do have a product that is getting so close to each other. Do they eventually need to merge into one?
Mm-hmm. Peter, here's one for you. This is from Ed Joris. He says, do you agree with me that for the sake of non-NASCAR road racing, that IndyCar and ALMS need to form some kind of business partnership, if not an outright merger?
Well, it wouldn't be a merger of equals right now, because IndyCar is definitely the one.
Bigger name.
I think the dual weekends are really good. They give the enthusiast consumer a lot of bang for the buck, and it makes all the sense in the world. And if IndyCar or AMS wants to partner up with IndyCar, I think would be smart, because there's very few weekends that AMS can run on their own anymore. And I think, Sebring and Petit Le Mans, otherwise they should be partnering up with IndyCar.
Uh-huh. Steve in Redlands, California says, the Fremont California plant, the NUMMI plant that was the joint venture between Toyota and GM, was said to be perhaps the best assembly plant in North America in terms of the quality of the cars it produced.
That's not true.
It was a good plant.
It was a good plant for a while, but it was exceeded by several other plants.
Right.
By both Ford and GM.
And so this guy goes on to say, and who is this? I guess I don't have the name there. He says it was, I said that at the beginning. it's Stephen Redlands, California. He said it formerly was a GM plant and was apparently a textbook example of lousy Detroit management and union excess and abuse. We'd love to hear our take on it. It was. It was a poor plant. Toyota took it over. They did the whole Toyota production system thing. It turned out to be a very productive plant. But Toyota walked away from it, and GM collapsed, and then Toyota walked away. And this is something that the UAW is, I think, going to start to face as it has announced it wants to organize a transplant. There were three UAW organized transplants: NUMMI, the one that this guy is talking about, Diamond Star in Bloomington Normal, Illinois, which is on its last legs. And what used to be known as Auto Alliance here in Flat Rock, Michigan, which Mazda used to run, and Ford's sort of taken it over. And there's question marks as to whether that plant's going to survive either. So my take is, the union's got to be able to prove it can take over a transplant and have this thing healthy and keep on running. Hey, Ben, did I hear we had a call come in? Should we bring a call in here?
Hey, good day, John. My name is Jim John Matisse. I'm calling from the U.S. Virgin Islands. My question is, do you know Ford plans to build another Ford GT, something to compete against the COVID? Seeing that I'm a third-generation Ford nut, and do you have plans to bring anybody on your show, drag racing legends, especially in the Ford arena? Thanks, and you guys are great. I'm the extremist. You're my kind of guy. Okay.
We had a great show last summer from the Ford Museum, and we had John Force and a bunch of drag guys on. So, but I can answer that. There's not going to be another Ford GT anytime soon.
Ah, oh, darn it.
Barb doesn't have to be put on the spot. I can tell you that's not going to happen.
But right now we don't have plans for why, I can tell you that. Right now we don't have plans.
Yeah.
Should Ford have something to take on the Corvette?
That's an interesting one. I don't personally.
Ford GT took on the Corvette. It was like, another classic car.
Yeah, Ford GT was another classic car. And we certainly have, Shelby's with our Mustang line. Mm-hmm. And we take our Mustang line up very, very far in terms of, performance vehicles. So for us, I think, and for a lot of customers, I think it does fill that niche for them that they're looking for. But the Corvette in and of itself, we're much more focused on something like a Mustang. And, having something that's not just fast and fun, but also very, very affordable, which is what distinguishes the Mustang. But we do take it up with our Shelby variants and, KR variants, and oh my goodness, all the things that we do to that product that certainly competes.
Oh yeah,
on
like the new Laguna Seca 302 is just awesome performance.
Awesome vehicles, awesome performance vehicles.
But should Ford have a halo vehicle? I mean, I doubt that General Motors makes money on the Corvette. I really do. Yeah. But it does bring people into the Chevrolet showrooms who may not otherwise go in there. And I think it really can. I don't think it quite yet, but I think the Corvette can really stand for something like it once did, and I think the next generation will get there. But I'm just asking, should Ford have something that they go, ta-da, look what we can do?
If we just look at the last, two or three years, and how we've progressed the brand and the brand image, I think we've done extremely well without having anything you could point to as a ta-da, I think there's a lot of heritage at Ford. There's a lot of family at Ford. And then the ability to put out outstanding and fantastic products that really sets the halo for us across the board with our customers, I think it's done pretty well. When you look at our brand perception in the marketplace, when you look at customer loyalty, and right now I think we just moved into first place in a Polk survey on customer loyalty. So that's what you'd want to do, right, with a halo product. And I think we've been pretty very successful in actually achieving it without having one, and instead using that money, that time, and that attention to really perfect the mass products that we're sending out to folks.
Darn it, that answer makes sense to me, but I want a halo car.
Make sense, but that's a very rational, non-emotional answer, wasn't it?
I think down the road, you know, if we see Ford back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with an engine, and maybe eventually back at Le Mans, that trickle down will just naturally flow to your products. And plus, there's a next generation Mustang coming.
Always Mustang. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. What's your whole thought? Peter and I are so pro racing and using motor racing as a way of developing mm-hmm. technology. What are your thoughts along those
yeah,
lines?
Yeah, actually, very much agree with you. Then a lot of the Ford racing products that we put out, a lot of the, especially for like the Mustangs, a lot of the work we do starts with a racing team, starts with the Mustang, and then it cascades into the mainstream technologies, not just for Mustang, but for other products also. So it is a very good, I don't want to call it a test bed, but it's a very good proving ground for some of the technologies that we want to cascade to, you know, broader products.
Great. Ben, do we have another call there?
Hi, this is Jim from Sioux Falls. Sam, I'm wondering if Barb could talk a little bit about the plug-in F-150 that's supposed to be coming up at the SEMA show. Saw it on Autoblog Green, and it looked like a pretty cool vehicle. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Well, I think that's probably being done by one of our partners or, you know, in conjunction with us helping them doing a, because we do have some converters that take F-150s. They'll also take Econolines and convert them into electric vehicles. So I think that's what you'll be seeing at SEMA. Right now, as we look at delivering that kind of, you know, jaw-dropping next generation fuel economy in pickup trucks, right? For a F-150, it's really taking a lot of the weight out of the vehicle without impacting the payload capability. So we maintain all the payload capability and going down in engine. So it's further, you know, downsizing in the engine offerings that we provide there. But I, you know, we are always working with people that that take our product and they do convert it into, you know, into like a hybrid, you know, in an aftermarket kind of manner.
I don't think the pickup truck consumers are quite prepared for what's coming and to meet the mileage standard.
No, they may not be. I just don't see, and maybe things will change, typical pickup buyer going for a plug-in pickup.
That's, you know, because first of all, you'd need a battery, which is taking up space. And when you get into the pickup trucks, the best thing you can do is make sure they don't have any idea how you delivered that great fuel and met those regulations, because they just want they need that product to have the towing capability and to have the payload carrying capability. And a battery, unfortunately, is very heavy these days. You know, I'm sure as battery technology continues to evolve and the energy density gets better and the weight management gets better, it'll become a very viable technology across a broad range of products. But for right now, you don't want to do anything that impacts that payload. So our objective is, you know, customers won't actually even know everything we've done to a vehicle. They just know this thing's got better performance, feel better fuel, and better payload capability than the one I bought last time.
What are you doing about reducing weight? I mean, Detroit Products, notoriously, not so much you guys, but even so, historically, Detroit Products have always been pretty heavy, and any kind of material substitution is a very costly way of getting lighter weight. Are there other things that you can do from a design standpoint, section design, especially,
oh, absolutely.
I'm wondering, to take weight out?
Oh, yeah, it's weight is another one that's an intensive attention to detail to continually manage weight. But first, you do have to start with, you got a shadow area for a vehicle. If you have the biggest shadow area of anybody else, then your vehicle will probably be heavier than anyone else. So you start with fundamentally setting up your proportions so that you get the right shadow area to meet all the needs of the customer, but not disadvantage yourself or give yourself any extra size and weight that you have to take care of. But in an existing platform, there's all kinds of technologies we utilize, as well as just that attention to detail. If you have, a solid disc, the component in a vehicle that's a disc, you can put lightning holes in it. You just, you know, literally take out some of the weight by adding some holes. paying very close attention to section management. When we do all of our crash management, making sure that we take the crash pulse and that we distribute it in the most cost-effective, the most effective manner so that we can make sections as thin as possible. And, you know, you're just paying attention to all those things. Seat technology. We have a thin seat technology that we've been working on that's just amazing. So, you know, if you open your door and you look at the width of your seat, you know, it takes up a lot of room there, right? You got about 8 inches. But this is, you know, taking that and cutting that even in half. So there's lots of design and technology. And typically when you take out material, you also make it less expensive. So there are some weight buys that we do. Sometimes we do decide to spend money to take weight out, but there are more times where we just get our designs more efficient and we take out more weight. And typically the path we have been on is the design efficiencies that don't cost you anything. You're actually taking weight out and in many instances saving money as you're taking that weight out are far more than where we actually pay for weight reduction with a new material or a new technology.
That's the best of both worlds.
That's the best
of both
worlds.
Cut cost and weight.
Right. Absolutely.
As Colin Chapman said, add lightness.
Add lightness. There you go.
That's great. Hey, we're coming up at the top of the hour. I'm just, Ben, we got any more calls that we should get to?
This is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question this week is Ford ever going to export the Ford Mustang or any plans to export the Ford Mustang to Europe? I have some cousins in Poland who constantly ask me about it. They read the American car magazines, and they just love that car, and it's a great, iconic American vehicle.
Yeah.
Just curious. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks for your question, and thanks for calling in. But as we're looking at all of our product lineup, even those that are regional, having a mechanism to decide whether or not we've got a business case to take it global is definitely something we're looking at. So
I am so down for the American manufacturer.
I don't have any specific plans right now to do that, but that is definitely something we're thinking about.
Yeah, I like this question because I'm so down on the American manufacturers. I don't think GM, Ford, or Chrysler do nearly enough to export vehicles out of this country and start helping our balance of payments that way. Because I agree with him. I think the Mustang would do well.
Yeah, there are many markets that would like the Mustang.
In fact, I still think you guys ought to try. Stick your toe in the water. Take an F-150 over to China. See what happens. Because I think there's a true car culture developing in China. I think they'd flip over those pickup trucks. I know everybody tells me I'm crazy.
Well,
I think somebody ought to stick their toe in the water and see what happens.
Yeah, again, I see that market. I actually see the car market very much like the North American market. The drivers are looking, Chinese drivers seem to be looking for the same types of attributes that we have in North America, which are different in the U.S. than you say European. You know, automatic transmission, looking for the same kind of shift quality we have. The size of the vehicles,
bigger cars.
But I also see it's the same kind of, you know, truck segment seems to be evolving. That's evolved in the rest of the world, which keeps us, you know, the only guys driving around in the big pickups, traditional pickups.
I think some people might be
surprised.
That's
interesting. I'll take that back to our planners.
Okay. Well, they'll tell you it's crazy. Because that's what everyone's told me. Ben, let's bring in another call here.
Good evening, people. This is Youngblood from Cleveland, Ohio. Got a question for Barb Smartis. In the future, what do you or do you see a V6, that like 3.7 liter V6 single turbo EcoBoost for the Mustang? That's a wild setup you have right now and could really use a turbo. That and another question. Remember back in the mid-80s, you had the SVT Mustangs with the, I think it was a 2.3 turbocharged four-cylinder. You think we might ever see one of those again? A real wild four-banger in a Mustang, lighten it up a little bit, make it a real sweet piece. I'm interested in your answers. Thank you very much, and have a good evening. Bye.
Thank you. You know, as we take our EcoBoost strategy and we cascade it across more and more platforms, I think having a downsize like an I4 engine with turbocharging in a Mustang platform would be, you know, a very viable solution. But I think it goes back again to making sure that we deliver. That would be a V6 replacement, if you will. So that V6 customer's got certain expectations for, you know, the performance feel, the drivability, the sound of the engine, you know, that it's going to sound like a Mustang. And making sure we deliver all that, and if we can deliver all that in an I4 package, that is a good solution for that customer because, again, it provides that fuel economy opportunity they're looking for. I'm surprised he mentioned a V6 turbocharged because normally Mustang customers want the five-cylinder to be the turbocharged one for the EcoBoost engine in Mustang. So that's the question I usually get. Why don't you turbocharge that 5-liter? Turbocharge that V8.
Yeah, although I like him pointing out the SVT Mustang, which was a pretty cool Mustang. I like that whole series.
Yeah.
Real driver's cars. Ben, we got another one?
Hey, John. This is Doug D'Agostino in Riverside, California. And I'm interested in knowing about the Fusion engine selection, when they're going to get an EcoBoost, and what size EcoBoost it will be. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. Unfortunately, I can't give you specifics at this point in time because we haven't announced all of that. But I am going to say, you know, an EcoBoost and a Fusion is a natural. So,
yeah, right. An EcoBoost and every engine compartment.
Here. I don't want them to come running over. So,
right. Let's bring in another one, Ben.
Yeah, hi, guys. My question is, in the near future, with all these small four-cylinder charts, do you think there's a niche for a two-seat sports car, like, say, the old MG that they used to make and the Triumphs? I think there's a they'd sell them, I mean, especially with the motors they're producing now. Okay, hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks. Two-seat sports car?
You never know.
Niche is the key, right? Niche is the key word in that discussion because, you know, we've had two-seat – there's two-seaters out there, but they're always very, very small volume. They do very well the first couple of years, and, you know, then they just serve a niche purpose.
I think the key with Ford is always that when it's performance, it's Mustang, and the only other possible way to go was like the Ford GT. And so I don't see them doing it. You and I are probably the only ones that remember what that original Mustang concept looked like. Remember that?
The Mustang
thing was really sweet, little mid-engine.
Mid-engine thing, right.
But, you know, the Mustang franchise is Ford. So.
Absolutely.
But, you know, even though, you know, if you talk about it being a niche, if it's a niche in 100 markets, it might add up to some reasonably good volume.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you might see a two-seater Lincoln.
Well, now you're talking.
Now you're talking.
Because, yeah, I like that idea a lot.
Dramatic two-seat rear-wheel drive Lincoln that when people say, wow, that's a Lincoln.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
That's what they need to do.
Ben, do we have another call?
Hey, John, this is Rick from San Diego. I was wondering if Lincoln was going to consider a 3-Series C-Class competitor. I mean, in 2008... the market was about 900,000 globally, and I think it's a great opportunity. Any comments? Thanks.
Yeah, as we go through our whole revitalization of Lincoln and look across the Lincoln product, we recognize we have some, you know, holes that we'll want to fill. So I think our objective is going to be to have a full product lineup in that segment, you know, whether it's a 3-Series competitor and all the way up. So that's the you know, the opportunity we have with Lincoln to, as we revitalize it, is to make sure that we put product out that fills all those niches.
And he raises a good point. That is a volume segment in the luxury segment.
Yeah.
So, yep, that makes a lot of sense to jump into. Ben, do we have another call yet?
Hi, this is John from New York. The EcoBoost Ford Taurus police car is about $10,000 cheaper than the Taurus FHO EcoBoost V6. Is Ford now more a fleet company instead of a consumer-oriented company? Thank you very much. Bye.
I didn't know we had announced the pricing on the police cars yet in the Taurus police.
I hadn't heard it.
I haven't heard that one yet. So I guess I'm, you know, you can just use the data and look at the data. We have done an excellent job of managing how much goes into fleet, how much goes into retail. The police is a very, very important fleet customer for us, extremely important. And making sure that we are able to offer them, as we phase out our Crown Victoria, that we are able to offer them a fantastic product that not only meets all the needs that the Crown Vic has served for them for many, many years, but also exceeds anything our competitors can offer them is absolutely crucial for us. And that's very important business. So
yeah.
I'm proud to have that business.
Yeah,
we want to keep that business.
And everybody else wants to steal it away from you now that the Crown
business.
Vic's going away.
But I think overall, I know I find this personally when I go out on a trip and want to rent a car, I sometimes have trouble finding a Ford in the rental fleet to rent. Because we just have really backed off a lot. Yeah,
wow.
We've cut back a lot.
Jeez. Ben, do we have another call here?
Yes, my name is Andrew. I'm calling from Elkhart County, Indiana. As a manufacturer of recreational vehicles, I'm curious as to where the future plans for sport utility vehicles and that how it pertains to trailer ability and the towing ability of these vehicles moving forward as people are beginning to downsize from full-size SUVs to mid-size SUVs. Thank you.
Oh, interesting question.
Yeah, well, I think there's a place for both the small, mid, and full-size SUVs. So something like our Navigator or our Expedition, I think that's going to be an option for customers that need full towing capability for a very long time. And the challenge there is to make them more and more fuel efficient so that they're not disadvantaged by the fact that they need to have that towing capability. And that's where strategies like our EcoBoost come into play in making sure that as we, again, cascade those across all of our platforms and further out along our product line, that we could realize that. And then, you know, midsize, we just did a total revamp of our Explorer. And that's, you know, got great fuel economy and got, you know, very good towing capability, 5,000 pounds. We've got a really great product there for a customer that's, you know, looking for some more of a midsize traditional utility.
What about, because we haven't talked about the vans, that Econoline's been around forever.
Yeah.
You've got this terrific van in Europe, mm-hmm. Transit. Again, one Ford. Do you see them converging? And apropos of the person who just called in, Econoline's used a lot.
It's the fleets, yeah.
Also in the RV segment. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys sell a lot of Econoline chassis that get built up into other things, too. So
yeah.
Whither Econoline in the future?
I think Econoline will be with us a long time, but I think that starting that transition to get our, and again, Econoline has a lot of fleet customers, and we also send them to the, the upfitters, the chassis to the upfitters. And we've been working very closely with them to expose them to our transit product in Europe and to get their feedback on it. Because the one thing we want to do, again, it's like the police fleets. You want to be really sensitive that the product you're going to offer these folks is going to meet their needs, that they understand the conversions involved in actually changing. Because, you know, that's one thing with our fleet customers. It's a big decision to change a platform or to go, say, to another manufacturer because you've got your whole fleet, everything you've done to customize, it's set up around one platform. So we've been in a very good dialogue with our fleets trying to understand if we did go to a platform like our Transit Global platform and take that into North America, how would it play with an Econoline? What would conversions look like? What would they be thinking of in terms of what they'd need to understand about the product to make it a viable choice for them? So that's definitely something we're thinking about and, you know, actively working with our fleets on to just really understand what the potential might be.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, you know, that Econoline has just been a fantastic product for them. So we will keep that one also, of course.
Ben, we got another one?
That's it for tonight.
Okay, real good. Well, thank you all for having brought in so many questions. And thank you, Barb, for
coming in
and talking all about this stuff. This has been fantastic. And Peter, great seeing you again.
Thanks, John.
And
great,
we'll do it again next week.
Yes, we will.
So got to thank everybody who's watched everything. Thank our sponsors for making this whole show possible. And please join us again next week.
Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Outerline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outerline Detroit. That's all there and much more at OuterLineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.